Coming up today, fake news in a post-truth world, Airbnb's plan to take on the whole travel industry, and we find out why apps are dying and what's about to replace them. You're listening to episode 294 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Amelia Heathman.
Hi.
And Matt Burgess.
Hello.
We've just had Wired Retail, and regular podcast fans will notice that there are two podcasts this week. One of them is one that we did at Wired Retail with a couple of the speakers, and this is our regular one. So you get an extra bonus dose of Matt Burgess and Liat Clark this week. So, I mean, we learned a lot about retail, but I don't want a retail-based fact. Matt Burgess, what did you learn this week?
I haven't got a retail-based fact. I've got a very good one about biscuits. And it is, there is a new world record for biscuit dunking.
This is important.
It's possibly the most important thing for the whole podcast. A man has bungee jumped off of a crane or something like that and dunked a biscuit into a mug of tea from 75 metres.
Hero of our times. And the video is amazing because he nails it. He absolutely gets the biscuit right in the middle of the mug. Mug doesn't spill.
Well, you don't go into these things without practicing. You have to do some preparation beforehand.
How on earth do you?
And I think he actually had a special technique where he put both hands over the top of each other to hold the biscuit to stabilize himself.
Oh, I guess so. Pro. In case the biscuit accidentally flew out of your hand during the 75 meter drop.
Which would be a disaster. Amelia, what did you learn this week?
I have an animal-based fact, my favourite, as usual. And so I found out this week that only three bird species produce a type of milk to feed their young. Penguins, flamingos and... male emperor penguins and pigeons and flamingos.
Milk.
It's kind of like a weird, curdy type nutrient-rich substance that both male and female pigeons create, and I really like this equality in the bird world.
So they vomit up curdy milk.
Yes, but it's similar to like human milk in that it is full of like proteins and nutrients that are necessary for their little birds to grow.
Cool. Learn something new every day. I learned that not everyone in the world nods to say yes, which could be quite confusing. So in Greece, Iran, Lebanon, Syria, Turkey, Bulgaria, Albania, and on the Italian island of Sicily, a single nod of the head up, not down, indicates no.
What does like a multiple nod mean? Like no, 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 no?
But no, you just have to keep on flicking your head upwards, which doesn't really work to demonstrate on a podcast. And give it a go. Go to Greece and nod up at someone and see what happens. Our first story this week is not about facts. It is about lies.
Lots of lies. So I'm going to give you a couple of headlines to begin with. And I want you to tell me if these are true, real stories that exist in the world or something that maybe somebody's made up. So number one, gaming addict and elderly grandma filmed in internet bar, swigging beer and smoking with two young children.
True.
Yeah, I think that's true.
That is completely true. That was an easy one to start off with. Second one, scientists define smart casual.
False.
Yeah, James has already got that right. Sorry.
I was going to make a play for that, but I guess, you know, you gave it away.
Okay, next one. Giant natural snowballs are as big as basketballs discovered on remote beach.
True.
False.
Thank you for getting it wrong, Amelia. Just to make sure this wasn't too easy. And the final one. UKIP urged government to do something about the moon.
False.
That is like a definition of an Onion headline.
And that is actually what it was.
Yes.
It was a headline from the Onion. That was a fantastic link.
And so we're good. We're good at spotting fake news.
Yes, you are. But it turns out a lot of people in the world might not be. And this is the story that there has been a lot of fake news being shared around the US election on Facebook and on other social media platforms. And basically after the election, Mark Zuckerberg came out and said that it would be crazy to think that people sharing fake news on Facebook actually had an influence or a play on how other people voted in the election.
Right, and this is the US presidential election. Donald Trump's victory was a bit of a shock for some, and in amongst all of the think pieces and the head scratching and how did this happen, some people have suggested that these echo chambers, we talked about them before on the podcast, on Facebook, on Twitter, on people's social network feeds, are tricking them. But a big part of that echo chamber is that turns out a lot of it's lies.
Yeah, so there are a lot of fake news websites out there in the world. So there are a couple of different categories, really. I would say The Onion and other websites that do spoof parody news is they're one example of a type of fake news, and there are others that are a bit more serious. So those ones that I gave you that were false earlier were obviously parodies meant to raise a smile, a bit of a joke, and nobody would really take that they're seriously, although a lot of newspapers in the past have actually fallen for those sort of fake news ones. But there are also fake news websites that put out stories like Denzel Washington backs Trump in most epic way possible, Democratic operative was murdered after agreeing to testify Hillary Clinton. There are a couple of recent ones, and these are just created by news websites that are actually meant to just get people to click on them and raise ad revenue, and people share these thinking that they're real.
Yeah, and the trick here is, and I'm sure we all agree, that if you see something that says Denzel Washington backs Trump in most epic way possible, it's that virally clickbaity, well, what is the most epic way possible? Why is Denzel Washington backing Donald Trump? It encourages you to click and to be outraged and to share it. So there's big money in this, and people don't necessarily care if it's true or not.
No, and that's the point. I think that this is where the big questions about how Facebook's algorithms and how what it promotes actually as news stories actually comes into play, because Facebook is based around engagement, people liking, sharing, clicking. The posts get actually pushed out to more people if more people interact with a post. And if it's something you agree with, you're probably more likely to share it. So in the example, Pope backed Trump, which was a news story that was obviously not true, but people thought it was, shared thousands of times, and then it's making people who are making these websites money and just sort of reinforcing beliefs. So people are saying, Facebook, you probably should be doing something about this.
I think it's interesting linking it back to Donald Trump, because I felt that, you know, this election cycle has obviously gone on for what feels like centuries, but it has been very long over the past 18 months, and every headline said, oh, you'll never guess what Donald Trump said. Donald Trump said this. That was happening, you know, last year when he was starting to run and things. So it is interesting that, you know, that clickbait was going on with normal news sites. It's like, how do you differentiate between what's real and what's fake?
But essentially, when a politician like Donald Trump, or in the UK, some of the politicians that campaign to leave the European Union, whether you agree or disagree with them, they speak in clickbait. They speak in sound bites, in these very attractive, compelling phrases where you can very, very clearly understand what they're trying to say. They don't hide behind any kind of artifice or edifice. And when that gets translated into Facebook, well, Facebook surely has the power to understand, and the tools available to understand, what's real and what's fake. I mean, for one, anything on The Onion is fake. So just say it is.
Yeah, so that is what Facebook is trying to look at and do now, potentially. They've said they're actually going to build some tools that are, and they've had some in development for a little while, but haven't rolled them out yet, which they're going to do something with. But there's been a lot of criticism about why they didn't do anything during the election cycle, that Facebook didn't play an influence, which actually, Facebook has boasted about it getting 2 million people to vote, which is having an influence on the election anyway. If those people weren't going to go out and vote, but they have because of Facebook, the argument that what is on Facebook doesn't really play out as being a truthful one. So this week, Facebook and Google have both taken fake news websites off their advertising platform. So these people can't make money off these sites through their platforms anymore. So that's one step that they're doing, but there's going to be a lot more that they're actually going to have to do around answering questions about their algorithms, their transparency, and what is actually promoted, and if they should be actually flagging things up as fake.
And there's been an awful lot around this week. So I think it was Gizmodo who broke the story that a few months ago or a few years ago, Facebook started developing an algorithmic tool that could spot on news feeds fake news, root it out, and make sure that it doesn't appear. But according to sources that Gizmodo spoke to, that tool unfairly, or seemingly unfairly, air quotes, affected right-wing news sites. So it was canned. It was shelved. Facebook says that this isn't the case and hasn't really made much more of a comment about it. But there's an interesting contradiction here, right? Facebook makes such a big play about how influential it is, how big its reach is, that if you advertise on Facebook that you're getting in front of all of these people and that they'll buy your products and be interested in what you have to say. And then on the flip side, Mark Zuckerberg says, no, we didn't. Fake news on Facebook didn't influence the election.
Yeah, it's a platform that's got 1.6 billion daily users now, and I think Facebook does have to really think about what it does in these circumstances and how it disseminates information to people. And it's a really tricky question, because it doesn't want to be seen to being biased, but also it doesn't want to be seen to be sharing fake news. So there's going to be a lot more to come on this, and it's up to Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook what they do about it. But there have been calls for algorithmic transparency from Angela Merkel and lots of other people. So it's going to be something that keeps running.
Yeah, and we should briefly say, just to end this, it's not just a Facebook problem. While it is a very, very big problem on Facebook, so shortly after the election finished, the result was known, if you typed in final election count into Google, which might be quite a popular search, a fake news story claiming that Donald Trump won the popular vote cropped up. At that time, Hillary Clinton led by about 500,000-600,000 in the popular vote, maybe a little more. It's now in excess of 1 million. And, well, appropriately, admittedly, shortly after that was spotted, all the news sites wrote about it, and then the top link, when you type that in, was all the debunking stories. So, swings and roundabouts, but surely when people type something into the internet or see something on the internet, they believe it's true.
They do, unfortunately.
Yes.
And we should all be a little bit more critical.
Yeah, and news sites should be a little bit more responsible, perhaps. Well, what does everyone else think? It's got us excited. Amelia?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And obviously it links back to, obviously the Oxford English Dictionary announced their word of the year this week, which was a word, not an emoji, as post-truth. And I guess this fits exactly into kind of what we've been experiencing this year. Just saying how strange 2016 has been on the whole.
Let us know your thoughts at YGK on Twitter, or I'm at Jay Temperton.
I'm at Matt Burgess 1.
And I'm at Amelia X 1.
Our second story this week is about one of the biggest startups to come out of the US, Airbnb. So this is the biggest launch that Airbnb has ever done. It's called Trips. And if you haven't read about it already, it essentially comprises around 500 experiences in 12 cities around the world, including Los Angeles, San Francisco, Miami, Detroit, Havana, London, Paris, Florence, Nairobi, Cape Town, Tokyo, and Seoul. I say including, that is all 12. So at the moment, if you go on Airbnb, or until now, if you went on Airbnb, you could book somewhere to stay. Now, if you go on Airbnb, you can book something to do. And they see this as a pretty fundamental change to what they're doing. And as a $30 billion company, one of the, I think it's the third most valued private company in the world, startup in the world. It's interesting.
It's a big change. Is it basically just like a holiday then that you book through them? Like
yeah,
more fully encompassed package without flights, etc. Or I don't know. But
it would be interesting if they did start to offer flights in the future. So it's basically everything that you. Airbnb wants to be the place that you go to for everything that you do on holiday. So you go on holiday, what do you need? You maybe need a car, so you could hire a car. You might need cinema tickets or gig tickets, or you might want to go to an American football game, or you might need a mobile data plan so that you can use Airbnb out and about and do your Google searches and read your fake news. And as you know, a big part of what you do on holiday is you go and experience things, right? Everyone, well, not everyone, but a lot of people want that authentic experience. They want to go to the weird dive bars. They want to find the strange cultural phenomenon in the cities that they visit. And Airbnb's idea is that it can use its huge network of people and its huge network of users to kind of take that niche side of cities and make it mass tourism, which is slightly contradictory. So earlier this year, I went to San Francisco to go on one of these early trips, and rather than going to San Francisco and spending lots of time at Fisherman Wharf and on Alcatraz and looking at the Golden Gate Bridge covered in fog, the idea was that I would go and explore the woodlands and go out on a canoe in the San Francisco Bay and do something a bit different.
Did you feel like you had the authentic San Francisco true residence experience then on your trip?
This is where it gets a little bit difficult. So all of the 500 trips that Airbnb is launching, they've done merchandising around. So they've hired professional photographers, professional videographers. They've done beautiful design. So it's almost like you're booking yourself onto a Hollywood movie experience. It's so polished. And to an extent, that kind of goes against the idea of something being authentic. Something is authentic because you stumble upon it or because it hasn't been discovered by the world's third most valuable startup.
It kind of seems to me a little bit like the millennial version of a package holiday. Like it's particularly with the way that they've done all this amazing photography and videos and stuff, it's like the clean, shiny version.
Yes. So it's the idea of going off the beaten track, but you're only doing it through this very pre-booked, managed, polished experience that's been put together. And that's not to say that it isn't entirely enjoyable and it isn't a really cool way to see new things in a city. And crucially, and this is a big point that Airbnb made when I sat down with Airbnb co-founder and CEO Brian Chesky, his point when I criticized him to this thing, where you're just sort of coming up with a new kind of package holiday, it was, well, on a package holiday, think who you transact with. Where does your money go? So if you came to London, you might give some money to the Tower of London. You might go to M&M's World. You might eat an Aberdeen Angus Steakhouse restaurant or a Pizza Express or something like that. Whereas their idea is that you would spend your money with a local charity or at a really small restaurant that you've never heard of. So I went to pretty much a dive burger bar place that was recommended by my hosts. There you go. So you're transacting with different people. So yes, it is mass tourism, but it's redistributing that. So if you come to London during the summer, everyone is in the same place. All the tourists go to the same places. And this might start to spread them out a bit more.
It sounds like a perfect holiday for Instagram, really.
Yes, there is that too. Especially when you go to San Francisco, which I think was a city built for Instagram, which probably explains why it came out of there. But I kind of got a question for you guys. Do you use Airbnb a lot? Or
I've used it a few times. I went on holiday to Rome and used it there. I went down to Brighton and here in the UK and stayed in somebody's, basically their attic, and it was quite pleasant. Yeah,
I've actually never used Airbnb. I've always just kind of done hosteling, but I have so many friends that have done it and really loved it and had great experiences. And I guess if you're linking it back to the hosts, that's always been a good thing about it. You know, you're staying in someone's house, they can recommend the real things to do. So if they are tapping back into that knowledge and making it more available on a wider scale, I can see how that would work.
My criticism of it is this. So I have a favourite pub in London, and I like it because not a lot of people know about it. And this is just kind of the person that I am. I like it. It's a bit odd. It's a bit grubby, but it's nice, and it's a place where you can go and relax. I wouldn't want it to be the kind of place where people go to find an authentic experience. And I could imagine people in other cities being slightly annoyed when a website as powerful, well, a service as powerful and big as Airbnb starts beaming tourists into their authentic, unsport places. And it's kind of the problem that they've had with houses. So hostels tend to be in areas of cities, not near hotels, but they'll be in the middle of the cities.
They're normally a bit cheaper as well, so sometimes on the outskirts.
Exactly. But they won't be where people live, necessarily. Whereas Airbnbs, the idea is that you go and stay where people live. And the criticism is that once you start flooding neighbourhoods with tourists wanting to find something authentic, you then go to that coffee shop that's meant to be authentic, and it's full of people trying to discover themselves.
Changes, like, the whole dynamic of the area.
Yeah, so trying to do niche tourism en masse, that's a really, really tough problem to solve, but Airbnb thinks it can do it, and it's making a really, really big play for that. So,
and is this a thing that's going to cost a lot more as an extra, or do we not know that yet?
So the trips kind of vary. Some of them are a couple of days long. Some of them are just a few hours long. The one I did, which went over 3 days, was $150 per person, which is pretty good value to my mind, considering what I was able to get up to.
And that's not including your, that's not obviously not including your rent or whatever.
Yeah, so it would be that. And then if you wanted to, so the idea is that you spend all of your money for Airbnb. Airbnb takes its 15-20% cut, whatever it may be, and everyone's happy. So the potential for growth here, we talk about growth a lot at Wired, is huge. If Airbnb can get this right, then we've already seen what it's done to hotels. It could start doing this to package tour operators, to sort of authentic weekend experience companies. I mean, there's a huge, huge industry there. It's bigger than oil in some ways. So there's a story up on Wired.co.uk. You can go and read that. We've also got an interview with Brian Chesky, which you can read in an upcoming issue of Wired magazine. Amelia, our third story this week is about, well, it's a few stories, but they're all concerned with health.
Yes. So a couple of the stories I've done this week have all been to do with apps in the health sector. So the first one I'm going to talk about today is called Sea Hero Quest, and that is trying to get people to play a game and then feed that data back into research to understand dementia. It's interesting, this one is trying to work out how you can diagnose dementia or Alzheimer's early, but doing it through a game. So this is a way of doing it through an app, which is really easy to access, as a way to kind of open the research pool.
But the science is, it's hidden behind something, well, not necessarily cute and cuddly, but something that doesn't look like science.
Yeah, so what the app is it's a nautical game that where you have to try and save an old sailor's lost memories by sailing a boat around the high seas. And through this, the app records a player's sense of direction and sends us back to scientists, because navigational skills is, basically the scientists want to build up back a benchmark of navigational ability of healthy people, because when you develop a neuro condition like Alzheimer's, one of the first things you do is lose your sense of direction and you start getting lost.
And what you're able to do with a game like this, so it's been played by an awful lot of people.
Yeah, it's been played by 2.4 million people, which relates to about 9,400 years of lab-based research. So it's
which
really...
Which is just ridiculous.
Yeah, it's crazy. It was saying like the biggest ever study to do with this kind of thing before has only involved like 560 people. So it's quite amazing how a free app, which is a game on... it's on the App Store and it's on Google Play if you want to try it, can be accessed by so many people and open up just this huge pool of research.
So what did they find? It's early days for this yet, I assume.
So the app actually only came out in May 2016. We actually featured it in an issue of Wired like a while ago. And so they're just going to start trying to sift through it. So far they found that players' sense of direction actually declines after teenage years. So players aged 19 are 74% accurate on the game, and this figure starts just falling consistently. And then by the time you're like 75, it's about 46%. So
that's a really, really big change.
Yeah, I know. It's really huge. And also they did find that people in Nordic nations normally did better than the rest of the world, but they're not actually sure what that's to do with.
Weird.
But this is just kind of the start. It's just showing that, you know, they're only just looking at this one thing, but they're going to try and hopefully use it to turn into, you know, an early stage of being able to diagnose dementia and Alzheimer's, because it's such a difficult thing to do. And so this is like just one way of trying to work around it.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating that they actually can pull so much data from this and actually be able to collect much more than they would just from small trials that are probably a bit more rigorous in terms of their actual, like, their dimensions. But it's actually really fascinating that they're doing that. And they're not the only people doing this sort of thing. We're transferring apps into things that can improve health, are they?
Yeah, so this is the second one. This was actually created by an undergraduate student at the University of Buffalo in America. And they've created an app which can track eye movement to determine if a child is showing signs of autism spectrum disorder. So they want to try and speed up autism diagnosis, which is really crazy. But the same idea as this is that it's an app which is widely available. Potentially, once it's been through the right tests and things like that, would then be widely available. So a parent can just like try it with their child and check and see if they have autism, and if the signals are there, then so go on and get a proper diagnosis and things like that.
Tracking eye movement, which is a good indicator of potential early signs of autism.
Yeah, so it works by tracking eye movements of a child looking at social scenes, because apparently the eye movements of someone with autism is often different to someone without. It's obviously just the way that the brain, like your brain processes, you know, looking at things. So it's looking at social scenes in particular.
And unlike the Alzheimer's and dementia app, which has been played by 2.4 million people, this is really, really early stage stuff.
Yeah, it's super small. This has only been tested by 36 children. Half of the children involved had been diagnosed with autism, half of them hadn't. And it said that it had like a 93% success, but obviously it's such a small scale.
And some people not involved with the study had a few words of skepticism.
Yeah, so I spoke to Dr. Judith Brown, who's the head of knowledge and expertise at the National Autistic Society in the UK, and she said that, you know, parents should be cautious about thinking that an app like this can solve everything and diagnose something straight away, because autism is such a complex condition, and it affects people in different ways. So the way that affects one person isn't going to be the same as somebody else. So she said, you know, wait and see. Once it's been developed more, things might become more successful. And I think the team behind the app said they want to try and do it with like 300 to 400 children to try and like, you know, just get it in the process and see how it actually works out. But I think it's really interesting using something as simple as an app to you know, in healthcare. I think it's obviously opening up like a completely different aspect to research.
And the technology that it runs on, everyone's got a smartphone in their pocket pretty much these days, and they're packed with sensors. They've got gyroscopes and cameras and microphones and accelerometers. So the amount of data and complexity of data that they're able to interpret makes them ideal tools for medical research. Previously, this was something that would have to be done with a very specialist piece of equipment, whereas now you just develop the software to run on the very specialist hardware and you're away. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, definitely. And I think health is obviously something a lot that we talk about a lot at Wired, you know, obviously thinking about what's going to happen for the future and things like that. So it's interesting seeing this kind of happening before our eyes.
Chances are you're listening to this on a smartphone, in fact, at home or on a computer, or your smartphone probably isn't very far away. So take it out your pocket and let's say open up Facebook or Twitter and open up the menu on Facebook or Twitter and navigate to your profile, and now navigate to the bit where you have to edit your profile. So that's probably taken you a few taps. You might not have immediately known how to do it. It might be slightly counterintuitive. And if I was to say, now go and try and do that on Instagram, or go and try and do that on Kick, or whatever app you might be using, you're probably going to get a bit confused. You won't know how to do it.
Is there a way this could be made simpler?
Uh-huh. Right. So there are now 4.2 million apps available for Android and iOS, but 3/4 of American smartphone users download a grand total of 0 new apps per month. When was the last time? Well, actually, we're probably the exceptions that prove the rule. When was the last time, either of you, downloaded a new app?
Pokemon Go?
Yeah?
I downloaded a new app this week, which you can read about on the Wired website from the BBC, called The Story of Life. But unless, once you've got all the social media apps, there isn't always a lot more that you download apart from that, really, on a regular basis.
So you've maybe got like 20 or so apps on your phone, but there are 4.2 million of the things out there. A few years ago, when the iPhone first burst onto the scene, we were all told that apps were going to be this huge transformative technology, and it turned out to be the case. But they're not really ideal. There's lots of tapping, there's lots of weird menu designs. You're kind of having to behave how the software forces you to behave. So in the latest issue of Wired magazine, this was a feature I worked on a little while ago, we started looking at the emerging bot ecosystem. And there's an awful lot of people getting very, very excited and investing a lot of money, and this includes the likes of Facebook, Google, and Microsoft, and Apple to an extent, in conversational interfaces, in bots.
What is bot?
Well, actually, you know what a bot is, because you've got one at home.
I do. I have the Amazon Echo, which has got Alexa, the artificial intelligence powered speaking conversational interface. And a bot, as you say in your feature, James, is something that basically makes things simpler, goes through a process, automates something, and like you can just talk to it and it does stuff.
Yeah, and Alexa, it's clever, but it's also kind of dumb, right? You have a sort of understanding with it that it can only understand a certain number of things.
Yeah, so if I say, Alexa, can you turn the light on, for example, it might do that. But if I want to say something a bit more nuanced, like, Alexa, can you tell me who played Joey in Friends, it might struggle with that because there's a bit more context and a bit more difficulty to it. There's no real reasoning behind it. It can't understand fully. It can understand like certain commands and certain things that it's been trained to do, and it learns to do more. But in terms of actually understanding what I really mean by saying something, that's the next challenge, I guess. But yes, you're right, basically.
Yeah, and we're seeing things like Facebook Messenger bots, where you can have a conversation with a piece of artificial intelligence and it could maybe order you clothes or food or recommend you somewhere to go for a concert in the evening or whatever it may be. And at the moment, it all feels a bit like a gimmick, right? All of this seems kind of gimmicky. Amazon Echo is pretty gimmicky. These bots are pretty gimmicky. But more and more people are spending more and more time and money developing bots. But what I found is that they're not the kind of bots that I was thinking they would be. So you watch a Hollywood film, right? From Hollywood, Amelia, what do you see? What is a bot?
I was just thinking of it as being more like a robot. Yeah, so I guess you would picture it as a metal person, and yeah, you would maybe tell them something to do and they would kind of be at your every need.
But it would be human-like.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But I think that's the problem I've had in getting my head around bots, because when you hear bot, you do think robot, you think of like a humanoid thing, but it being a messaging interface, I think it is a bit complicated.
Yeah, so there's two kind of pools of thinking around bots. One is that they would be human, that companies like DeepMind that are trying to solve intelligence, and maybe this is what Amazon Alexa Echo, whatever you want to call it, might become in the future, is almost another human being, an artificial human intelligence. But on the flip side of that, you have dumb bots, right? Why would I want a bot to be like a human? Bots can be better than humans. So Phil Leiben, the founder of Evernote, who now works for a venture capital firm called General Catalyst and is investing an awful lot in early bot startups, says that they're like sheepdogs. Sheepdogs are amazingly good. he explains, at one particular task. They're way better at a human than rounding up sheep. But you wouldn't have a conversation with your sheepdog. You wouldn't necessarily even be kind to your sheepdog. I mean, you might, you should. Probably, you should probably be nice to the sheepdog.
You wouldn't get it to milk a cow.
No. But you slightly framed me with that. No, you would not get a sheepdog to milk a cow. And that's his point, right? That it is to an extent dumb, but it's superhumanly good at one thing. So he sees bots as being superhumanly good at doing certain things. So the early bots that we're seeing, and these are still quite basic, are things based in software like Slack. So there's a bot called GrowBot that looks out for praise. So we use Slack at work. Maybe someone writes a really great news story or, like, I don't know, an amazing tweet. Someone does an amazing tweet and someone goes, great tweet. GrowBot would look out for that and go, oh, Matt Burgess said great tweet to Amelia Heathman. And it would keep track of that. And then at the end of the month, it would put together, or at the end of the week, it would put together a report for a manager saying that, you know, certain people are not, I'm not sure how it would do it, but it would keep an eye on the kind of words that are used, around what sort of subjects, to whom, between whom, and I guess the idea is that rather than sitting down and having that conversation and maybe not getting accurate information, you'd be able to get that feedback by looking at data based on what actually happened.
Okay. I like that. I kind of see how that would work. I guess maybe in terms of a managerial sense, then you could be like, this person should do more of this because they're doing that well, and you can see that from the data that is being generated.
Yes, which to one extent leaves me completely cold as a bit of a Luddite. It's, ooh, but surely human intuition is better. But it's based on how people are actually interacting. So I guess there's a certain merit to it. It's already raised £1.3 million in two rounds of seed funding and is used by about 2,000 companies, including Starbucks. There's another one called Envoy or Envoy, which sends a direct message on Slack to an employee whenever someone arrives at the office to see them. So no more awkward reception desk ringing around trying to find where someone is. You just get sent that message. And I think as well, it can attach a picture of them that's been taken by a security camera. So you're sure of who it is. And then when you go downstairs, if you didn't know what they look like, well, then you will know what they look like. So Slack's putting quite a bit of money into this. It announced a $2 million investment fund to work with 14 startups on bots for its platform. But the other obvious one, obviously, is Amazon Echo, which has been a big deal in America for a while and is now coming to the UK and the rest of Europe.
Yeah, I have found it useful as a tool for doing a limited amount of tasks. Obviously, it's going to grow. There's going to be all things that are developed for it as a platform. But I would say, like, most of the time I use it for setting alarms, playing music, nothing that is really complex and involves a lot of artificial intelligence or knowledge from the bot. So it's the same with Siri and the same with Google's assistant. They all are becoming more intelligent and clever and can do things, but there's still like a set range of stuff, and you can't speak to it in a way that you would speak to a human. Like, if I want to say with the Echo, for example, what's the tube like, what you have to say what the app is called first. So you have to say, Alexa, ask tube status what the Piccadilly line is like, and that's just a bit of a non human conversation, really.
Yeah,
it's not as responsive, I guess.
And another point, so the idea is that you could be rude to bots, right? So you wouldn't go, hello, Alexa, how are you today? What's the Piccadilly line like? You just go, Piccadilly line.
Yeah.
Which I wouldn't be able to say to a human because I sound like an arse, but you can say it to this piece of technology, right? So you can, if you're of this mind, you can really hone down your interactions to, so it's just you asking for something and getting it back. So you can be as rude as you want.
Yeah, that doesn't matter. That should be something that can be done. But at the moment, all these bots are just a little bit like you have to force talking to them in a way that they understand rather than being completely natural and understanding slang.
Yes. And we should say that all the big names are into this. I mentioned it earlier. So in March, Microsoft launched an open source developer tool platform for bots. In April, Facebook announced its own bot developer platform based around Messenger. And in May, Google showed off Assistant, a new AI personal assistant. It's also launched its own sort of Amazon Echo Alexa rival. So there's an awful lot happening around here. And one of the investors that I spoke to that's looking very, very closely at bots made an interesting point to me, and I wonder if anyone here thinks it's true. Do you type more words than you speak?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
Based on those two answers, definitely we type more than we speak.
Very short answers.
It's different for us because we work in a job where there's a lot of typing.
Yeah.
But even still, the amount I send messages through Slack, through WhatsApp, through any other messenger apps, there's probably a lot more than actually said out loud, which is scary.
It certainly makes you think. I'm not sure if it's quite true, because you think how many words that we've said in the 30-35 minutes or so that we've been recording this podcast. You can speak very, very quickly and say an awful lot of things, whereas written communications tend to be a lot shorter and sharper and certainly more coherent than how I speak out loud sometimes. Another interesting area around this is China. So in China, they don't have the same app ecosystem that we do in the West. A lot of the major apps never really made a dent there. But one did, Weixin, which is WeChat in China, has about 762 million people a month on it, and they're booking taxis, checking in for flights, buying concert tickets, donating to charity, playing games, and interacting with government services, all from within a chat interface. So it's a bot. It's a very, very dumb bot that you can ask it to do something, and then it's just it's like Alexa. It's a version of branching. So based on certain responses and interactions, it will offer you more options. So it's the equivalent of calling up an automated phone line and press 1 for accept it's a little less painful.
And this is all like built into WeChat, is it?
Yes.
Do you mean it's like one bot or different bots?
You'd have different bots for different things and services. So
okay.
There's one bot that oddly Microsoft built, which is called Jiaois. And it was designed to mimic the language. It's an artificial intelligence powered chatbot that lives on WeChat. More than 40 million people have held more than 20 billion conversations with it. And it's trying to trick you into thinking it's a human, whereas another app might just let you order pizza or book a cab. So there's this whole range of different apps. And yeah, they all live within something that looks a bit like WhatsApp.
Yeah.
But there are way more features to it. So something like Jiaois can understand interactions in text, images, video, and voice.
So it's really a bit more developed than simply ordering pizza.
Yes, whereas something on Facebook Messenger, they might go, oh, it's kind of cool. You can type in the pizza emoji and the wine emoji, and then you'll get pizza and wine delivered to you by Deliveroo or Uber Eats or whatever it may be. So there's a lot going on in China that we're just not seeing over here. So in some restaurants, if you have WeChat open, scan a QR code, you can browse a menu, order food, and pay all within the bot. It's kind of a simple task, but it makes sense that you would do that through a bot. To me, anyway.
It does, and you've obviously spent a lot of time looking at this stuff. So are bots going to be the new apps?
Well, what do you think? Because I suppose I've drunk a little bit of the Kool-Aid here.
So have I. But yes, I think that in some respect, the bots are going to be part of a new ecosystem that we use for automating tasks, for doing tasks. But it depends on the artificial intelligence behind them and how human they can become. Because I really think that voice interaction is very, with a computer, with a device, after spending some time with Echo, is going to be the future. We are going to talk to things. Obviously, there's scenarios like being in the office where I don't know if that's going to come across there. But from my experience, just actually talking to something and getting it to give you answers and give you a response to stuff is going to be very big.
Amelia?
I think, obviously, you need... You almost kind of need like an app for it to work with. But I guess because a lot of them are integrated in messaging apps and things like that, I guess it just means that overall it will decrease the apps that you use. You won't need Uber. You won't need an Uber app anymore if you can order it through WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger. So, yeah, I guess so. I think it is interesting. I think people will. I mean, I'm still getting to grips with the whole idea, but I think people at first will be like, oh, bots, this is something completely separate. But once you know that it's basically just integrating into everything you're using, it's just taking out that step. I think there is definitely potential for it to kick off here the way it has in China.
And it's just thinking of all of the really little, slightly awkward tasks that you have to do. So a lot of people said that it's going to go big first in enterprise and business. So to take a couple of things that you might have done in your last week at work, you might be the person in your office that orders new office supplies. So rather than kind of looking around the office and working out what you need to get, your inventory for office supplies would be built into the bot. The bot would have knowledge of that, and you would then just go into a direct message channel in something like Slack or whatever it may be and say to the bot, order 20 pencils. And it might go, what color pencils? And it would say, is $9.99 okay, or whatever it may be. And you just type Y or click yes or whatever, something like that. You need to book holiday. an awful lot of holiday booking systems at companies are amazingly clunky and based on very, very old technology. You just get your line manager an instant message and say, can I have off September 12th to September 19th? And they would go, yes. And the bot would go, confirm. And you would say, yes.
So it's the mundane tasks that are probably going to be replaced first by bots.
The mundane tasks will be the first to go by the sounds of it, but then everything will start to go. And the dumb task that I asked people to do at the beginning of this section, open up an app, go through the menu, find a very specific thing, you just go, Facebook, find pictures of Matt Burgess in California. And it's already got all that data. I don't need to know how to call it up through the interface. It would just find pictures of you in California and I'd be able to look at you on your holiday having a lovely time.
On an Airbnb trip.
Yeah, there we go. Full circle. Okay, so that's it for the podcast this week. We hope you enjoyed your double podcast dose. We'll be back to just one next week. But that's it from us. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.